Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome back to Well That Aged Well. This week we have James Clark on the podcast and we are going to discuss the dissolution of the monasteries. And I also ask, how did this topic come about for the inspiration for this book?
Above all, because I was very conscious that this was a subject which had not been tackled by historians for many years. I'm sure because of the sheer scale of the topic, we're talking about an episode in Britain's history which touches every part of the Tudor Kingdom of England and Wales, more or less every community. And it's a topic which in some ways was always regarded as enigmatic, in that the source materials for this subject are surprisingly scarce, surprisingly thin on the ground. This is an episode in the history of the Tudor regime that has not left a very large or long paper trail. Many of the sources are fragmentary, and some of the key witnesses to the dissolution of monasteries under King Henry VIII have not left really very many records at all. So, for example, Thomas Cromwell, Henry VIII's chief minister, a notorious figure, a figure who's inspired novels and dramas. In fact, we have very few of the personal papers surviving of Thomas Cromwell. Critically, we lack most of his letters. Cromwell coordinates Henry VIII's government during the 1530s, and at the centre of that coordination is the dissolution of
monasteries. The power behind the throne.
He is the power. Now, he issues instructions in a vast correspondence, but when he falls from power, it's clear that most of his papers are destroyed, probably by those loyal to him who are keen to ensure that the implications of his work are not followed up. So we've lost a good many of the records. So what attracted me, I suppose, was almost the tantalizing prospect of investigating an episode in history where the source material has to be pieced together almost like a jigsaw. Grabbing at fragments here and there.
And it's brilliantly put together, of course. We are going to discuss this topic today, but I want to begin with, of course, to understand how monastic life and how the monasteries. I want to begin by starting a little bit about from the Middle Ages until Henry VIII's time. How did the monasteries function and what were the role in British society, English society, and what were life was like in, you know, the monastic world?
So monasteries had been in the Kingdom of England and Wales for centuries. So the monastic estate that the Tudor regime confronts is of great antiquity by the 16th century. And England's landscape, built environment, society and economy had grown up around them and with them and through them. So these institutions were bound into the dynamics of social and economic life. They were almost an organic part of how life in medieval England emerged, evolved, and was played out, which is, of course, why removing them, as with uprooting anything organic, it disturbs a lot of the life around it, because they were so organically part of the society that that we see in medieval England. They were very evenly spread across the Kingdom of England and Wales, to the extent that there really is no part of settled society, whether urban, suburban, or rural, which was not in some way connected to a monastery institution. And as a result, really, there is no community of people that does not have some contact, direct or indirect, with monastic life. Their involvement in medieval life in England and Wales extends beyond the religious. They are not just places of worship, but they are places of residence for people who are not monks. They are places of work, and they are a source of economic power. They are great landowners. They are employers of labour. They are investors in commercial and in industrial property. So they have an interest in pretty much every aspect of social and economic life. And they are also sites of cultural activity. So many monasteries are places of elementary education. They are also places of creative, artistic and cultural activity. Many books are made in monasteries, and other decorative arts are carried out in monasteries. So they are, in some ways, they are a sort of concentration of medieval life, both the more structural, economic and social aspects, but also the more artistic and intellectual aspects as well.
And of course, it's because of the monasteries as well that we have the ecclesiastical history of the English people that, you know, was written in a monastery by the Venerable Bede as well. So it's, of course, it's hugely significant for historical understanding.
Yes, that's right. In many ways, because they are part of the very fabric of life in medieval England, they are also the repository of its memory. They are confirming and clarifying the historical experience of medieval England, from the time of Bede and onward through the Middle Ages. Monasteries are the places where most of the annals or chronicles of past and present events are recorded. And in fact, they're so recognised as places of social memory that in the late Middle Ages in England, the monarchy looks to the monasteries to advise on its own course of action. So when King Edward I in England is planning on attempting to take the Scottish throne, he consults the records in the monasteries in order to determine his claim to the crown of Scotland. So monasteries have a very, very significant role in keeping the record of almost of England's very, very identity, which is why I think by the 16th century, for some people, it's almost impossible to imagine a world without monasteries, because they are part of that inherited identity that English people have.
And also, as my understanding is that they function kind of as hospitals as well for sick, and if you were sick, you would go to the monastery as well.
That's right. They are particularly, it's true to say, I think, in urban areas, they have an important role to play in providing social welfare. We know that in times of plague, monasteries will in fact open their gates to take in those who are afflicted by plague, and to care for them at a time when, of course, ordinary citizens would have shunned them. And in fact, in the 16th century, when the closure, for example, of friaries is proposed, some cities complain that if the friaries are closed, when there is next an outbreak of plague, there is a real danger to the other citizens, because the friaries have been accustomed to taking in the sick and the afflicted, and thus protecting the rest of the community. It is true, though, it's often assumed that if monasteries had healthcare facilities, that everybody in society nearby would have benefited from them. In fact, they were very hierarchical, and often it is only the elite in the community who are given access to that very high quality healthcare that a monastery could provide. So, for example, we know that sometimes abbeys would have allowed in the women of the social elite to be cared for during childbirth, but not the women of ordinary families of ordinary society. So sometimes I think we have to be aware of a sort of romantic view of monasteries. Monasteries were elite institutions. They were very powerful. They were a source of lordship and economic power, a huge presence in society, but not always an entirely altruistic one for everybody.
So what, by the 16th century, what kind of people enter monasteries? What kind of people did they accept to become monks, nuns, or abbesses, or that kind of people?
Well, there had been considerable change by the 16th century. In the early and high Middle Ages, the people who entered monasteries were often a broader cross-section of society. By the late Middle Ages and into the 16th century, particularly for monasteries of men, the what we would call the social catchment, that is the part of society from which monks were recruited, had narrowed, and they are really from the middling group in society. They are men not from titled families, not from noble families, not from necessarily the wealthiest in society. Generally, they were men from the ranks of society that were looking to better themselves, to improve their social standing, because a career in a monastery was an opportunity to, in fact, to gain influence. If you entered a monastery and you had the opportunity to become an abbot, for example, it would mean you had the opportunity to acquire significant status, to become the lord of a corporation that owned much property, and could exert even political influence. That was very attractive to families in that middling space in society that didn't have a noble title, didn't have a great estate. Their sons could enter a monastery and gain some of that that status by another route. A monastery career is attractive to men from families who wish to have the benefit of an education, because by entering a monastery in the 16th century, there was the prospect of gaining a university education, which would not necessarily have been open to them otherwise. Monastery recruitment was very different for women in England by the 16th century. For women, it still tends to be a path for women of high society, women from elite families. So women who become abbesses, prioresses, often have come from higher status families than the monks have done. And we still find women from noble families, sometimes women who are from families that are courtiers, even in the Tudor court, who are in entering a monastery and following a monastic life. So Henry VIII himself has family members who are living as nuns in England, and many other noble families have family members who are nuns. That was not the same for men. You don't see by the 16th century the sons of noble families entering monasteries. So there's quite an interesting social difference between men and women. But what they had in common was that the monastic life was a career. So most people entered a monastery in the 16th century in England at their teenage years. So you would enter a monastery at the same time as your peers might enter a school or be thinking of going to university. It's a career choice you make in your middle teenage years. It was quite unusual by the 16th century for someone, man or woman, to join a monastery later in life. You don't often find somebody in their 20s or 30s or even older entering a monastery in England. It was something that you did at the age of, say, 15, 16, 17, 18, and then you remained for your life. So it's what we would regard as a career choice.
So in a lot of medieval movies, when people go to the monastery, it's kind of a form of punishment. And you see them being treated, especially the nuns are being treated harshly in the monastery. So is this not a, was it was not a real accurate that it wasn't a punishment necessarily, as we see in some medieval movies, as they can be quite brutal?
No, that's right. We've distorted reality in the way that we represent the reasons why people entered monasteries. Of course, in some ways, it's an appealing idea that women are put into nunneries almost to constrain them, to as you say, to punish them, or when families discard a daughter who perhaps has no prospect of marriage. That is not typical either in the Middle Ages or by the time we get to the 16th century. On the contrary, families of daughters and sons are proud of their entry into a monastery, and they see it as what we would today describe as a career move, as a career opportunity, as a way of gaining status and influence. And we can see that 16th century families were proud to tell their neighbours of their daughters and their sons who had become nuns and monks. And it's simply not true that it was only the youngest daughter or son who entered a monastery. Not at all. Often, it was the other way around. In fact, that it was the eldest child of a family who would be given the opportunity to enter a monastery because it represented such a positive career step for them, that the privilege of entering a monastery would be reserved for the eldest child. So we have to adjust our outlook, I think, that to our own 21st century society, which in many parts of the world is very secular, the idea that you would send somebody to a monastery does feel to be a punishment. But in the religious worldview of the 16th century, of course, the opposite is true. And this would be a great opportunity that you would want to provide to your child and for your own family. So many of those who are in monasteries in the reign of Henry VIII, they chose to be there, and their families chose them to be there.
Before I move on, I want to ask about the title of abbess, because as we discussed, a lot of noble, and especially in the Byzantine world as well, there's when you see read about that the nobility and the queens retired to monastery, they often become abbesses. Was this a title mainly reserve the nobles and royalty, or was should let's say if my hypothetical daughter that's going into a monastery, should she become an abbess if she was just a normal lowborn woman as well?
Yes, absolutely. The abbess was simply chosen in principle as the individual best suited to govern the community. There's no doubt that because it was a prestige position, that external influences would shape the selection. So a well-born woman, a woman from a noble family entering a monastery, undoubtedly her family members would exert the influence they had to see her become abbess. So there's no doubt that a woman with what we would call good connections, good social connections, had a better chance of becoming abbess of her monastery than a woman without those social connections. But it's certainly possible that women who were not from the from royal rank or noble rank could become abbesses. And in fact, in England, we do see in the 16th century a surprising number of women who are relatively young becoming abbess or prioress of their monastery. So women as young as but still being in their 20s becoming head of their community. There is always in any church office, in any church appointment in this period, there's always manipulation. There's always external influence being brought to bear.
Sexual favors, could that have been happening as well?
There are always allegations of that kind. There is a famous dispute, in fact, over the choice of an abbess at a monastery in the south of England, in the county of Wiltshire, which involves both Boleyn sisters, Anne Boleyn, who becomes Henry's queen, and her sister Mary. And there are rumours there, both of them have preferred candidates that they want to see chosen. And there are rumours that one of these candidates is in fact guilty of sexual impropriety. And eventually, in fact, King Henry himself intervenes and says she must not be abbess because of the rumours circulating about her behavior. And it's a reminder that the selection of who would lead these monasteries was considered to be of such importance that it might even be discussed at court. The king might take a view as to who should be chosen, because the links between these monasteries and great families were very close. But you're right that in other parts of Europe, sometimes there was almost a sense in which the royal family effectively had taken possession of a monastery, and women of royal birth, princesses even, were placed in these positions as heads of monasteries. We don't see that so frequently in the late Middle Ages and in the 16th century in England, in the same way that we do say in Iberian monasteries, especially perhaps in the later period. So there is a difference there, which means that there are still opportunities for young women in England to rise to a position of influence.
Now, in the next phase, I wanted to say maybe it's time to introduce maybe not the hero, but if I may be so bold to say the villain of the story, which is Thomas Cromwell, and before because he's a key figure to the dissolution of the monastery. So, but before we go to this, I want to talk a little bit about how he came, because in my understanding, in the biography, one of the more recent biographies on him, that came from a bit of a humble background and then rose to power, become Henry VIII's right-hand man and the power, as we discussed, behind the throne.
Yes, he does. He comes from a very ordinary background, and we don't know much about his very early life and early career. We first see him very clearly in the service of Thomas Wolsey, Cardinal Wolsey, who is really the first figure to play the role of chief minister of King Henry VIII. In the early years of Henry's reign, Wolsey becomes the main power in Henry's regime in the course of the 15 teens and then into the 1520s when he's rising to almost a kind of supreme power. And Thomas Cromwell is one of a number of young men who are employed by Wolsey as agents carrying out his commands across the country. And Cromwell rises to the top of that group of those working for Wolsey. It seems, I think, largely because of his sheer energy, Cromwell manages to involve himself in all of the cardinal's schemes. And he proves himself to be indispensable. I think it's often said if you really want to be a success in your career, you've got to make it clear that you are completely indispensable, that your employer can't do without you. And that's exactly what Thomas Cromwell does. He becomes almost Wolsey's brain, I think it's fair to say. You know, he almost does Wolsey's thinking for him. He certainly does Wolsey's problem solving for him.
He's trying to put a little radar O'Reilly to Thomas
He's
well.
he is this consummate troubleshooter. He is able to push through all of those aims and ambitions that Wolsey has that are proving very difficult. Wolsey is trying to build his power as well as the king's in a kingdom which is not easy to govern because Tudor England is a very provincial society. It's very difficult to travel across Tudor England. Communications are very slow. Outside of the City of London and the centre of government, it's very difficult even to enforce the king's will without considerable exertion of power. And Cromwell, largely because he's got so much energy, he's tireless, he moves around the country, he is keeping in contact with everybody. He knows what's going on and he feeds that communication back to Wolsey. By the end of the 1520s, he has built a position that is so secure that even when Wolsey falls out of favor with Henry VIII, Cromwell is able to survive. Now, that isn't often the case in politics. If you've built your position through somebody else who is powerful, when their career is over, often your career is over too. Cromwell's genius, in a way, is that he's able to survive when Wolsey doesn't. And Henry is able to perceive that Cromwell has a usefulness in his own right, even though he has discarded the cardinal himself. So by the end of the 1520s, Cromwell is able to bring himself to the notice of the king, even after the cardinal has gone. And over the next few years, he's able to position himself effectively into the position that had been occupied by Wolsey. So he's able to position himself as the king's chief source of advice and chief minister. And in many ways, he's he's a more attractive source of advice for Henry, because Cromwell is not a churchman, so he doesn't come with all of the baggage of being a churchman. And Henry, at the point that he is breaking with the Roman papacy, he wants to secure his divorce. Having Cromwell's advice, which is detached from any influence of the church, is very attractive to him.
So, but was a worry for Cromwell when Wolsey was discharged that this might happen to me as well, or was he confident that I'm in such a secure position that this is not going to happen to me?
I think he is anxious, understandably, because the fall of Wolsey is quite sudden and total, and it's pretty clear that if Wolsey's health had not declined very rapidly, and of course he dies, that there was a real possibility that Wolsey would have faced a trial, possibly even execution. And Cromwell must have understood that he could have been part of the collateral damage of Wolsey's fall. He certainly has built himself up, but when Wolsey is finally overturned by the king, Cromwell is not at that point so secure in his power that he could have guaranteed his later successes. He is continuing to show himself useful to Henry. And he continues in the early 1530s to support the king, to advise, to assist the king in his various initiatives in order to build his position. It's really only with the confirmation of the marriage to Anne Boleyn in 1533 that then Cromwell's position does begin to look unassailable. Cromwell, of course, is very good at building alliances in the court, and the faction, the grouping around Anne Boleyn that has been moving to place her.
If I may, isn't it because of Anne Boleyn that Wolsey falls out of favour to Henry VIII, if I remember correctly, or is it before?
Well, Wolsey is falling out of favour already because of his failure to deliver on the divorce. So Wolsey is, of course, a churchman, and in some respects implicated in papal authority. And Henry wants to move faster and more decisively than Wolsey seems able to manage for him. So yes, the relationship between the two of them is already strained even before the marriage with Anne is a certainty. And of course, the marriage itself is not recognised until 1533. So Wolsey is long dead by that point. But Cromwell had already started realigning himself with other groupings at court, recognising that I think Wolsey's favour was beginning to fade. Cromwell was smart enough in reading the politics to recognize that he needed to build other alliances, and he continues to connect himself to the different groups competing for influence around Henry throughout the 1530s, and I think that's another of his successes, that he is able to connect himself to more than one group around the king, rather than being closely identified with any one. And that enables him to survive longer than most, because those different groups are constantly shifting and changing in the in their level of their influence over the king. Cromwell almost sort of stands in a middle position between them, and is able to when the Boleyn faction, of course, falls 3 years later in 1536. Although Cromwell had been close to them, he's not damaged by that change, and he remains able to hold his position remarkably and until 1540, in spite of the fact that Henry himself is changing his outlook constantly. Henry is a very unpredictable character, very unpredictable personality, and Cromwell somehow manages to stay almost one step ahead of that.
So I want to take a look at Henry's view on monsters, because if I remember correctly, Thomas Cromwell is the one who got the idea to dissolve the monsters. But what was prior to Thomas Cromwell say, hey, maybe we shouldn't get rid of the monasteries? What was Henry's view of the monastery and the monastic situation in England at the time before Cromwell comes in?
Well, Henry's outlook is on the church and on monasteries in particular is not what we might expect when we think of his reputation as the reformer of the church. Mm. Henry, as a young boy, grows up in a family which is very serious about religion and very committed to monasteries. His father, Henry VII, the first Tudor, and his grandmother, Margaret Beaufort, are both of them very interested in monastic religion, in the particular style of religious practice in monasteries, the what we call contemplative religion, and the strict discipline and the elaborate worship of a monastic church. And they are great patrons of monasteries. And Henry grows up in this environment. And early in his reign, he does seem just as committed as his father. His father had created an extraordinary memorial to the Tudor family in the Benedictine monastery at Westminster, Westminster Abbey. And it's Henry, when he succeeds his father, who completes all of that work. And he ensures that his father's great vision for a Tudor chapel at Westminster Abbey is completed. Now, that's the act of a young king who's continuing the family tradition. And Henry, we know, remains close to some of the monastics who had been spiritual or religious advisors to his father. And he's continuing those relationships all the way through the 1520s and even after the divorce into the 1530s. He continues to look to these people for advice. So right on the brink of when the closure of monasteries begins, Henry still has a notably strong affection for monastic religion. And in fact, through the 1530s, Henry's attitude to monasteries doesn't suddenly turn against them, but rather it seems to, I suppose today we would say, blow hot and cold. It seems to sometimes be harsh and cold towards them, and then suddenly return back to being quite committed to them. So after Jane Seymour dies in childbirth in 1537, Henry's immediate instinct is that he wants to create a new monastery with which to commemorate his much-loved lost queen, which is the sort of instinct that his father would have recognised. In 1536, he's creating new bishops, And the bishops he chooses are from a number of monasteries. So Henry has, I think we can only say he has a very conflicted relationship with monasteries. By the end of the 1530s, it's clear that Henry's enthusiasm for the reformed approach to religion is proving not to be very strong at all. And he is becoming ever more conservative in his tastes. So it's difficult to see Henry as a king who rejects monasteries and sets out to destroy them in any sort of systematic way. Cromwell's attitude is quite different. Cromwell is certainly close to many of the leaders, the abbots, abbesses of monasteries, and we know that he corresponds with them, he visits them. But he is not, in his own person, an enthusiast for their kind of religion. And he is clearly interested in the more reformed approaches to religion, where individual people take more control of their religious life, where they have access to reading the Bible for themselves. He is, I think we can probably say, a more moderate reformist Christian, very influenced by the humanist view that the old church had become quite corrupted and far too powerful, and it was important to return to the simple faith that is set out in the Bible. And he saw in monasteries more of the corruption of the old Roman church than he saw the simple faith. But neither of them set out in the 1530s with the idea that all of these institutions should be closed. Rather, Cromwell's view is that first and foremost, they should be reformed. They should be improved. They should be developed in a way that is more in keeping with the simple purity of Christianity. And in that, Cromwell takes his influence, I think, from Cardinal Wolsey, with whom he started his career. Wolsey was not opposed to monasteries, but he wanted them to be improved. And I think for some of the 1530s, that is Cromwell's attitude too. Not to close them all, but to improve them. And of course, this is what other regimes in other parts of Europe are doing. They're not necessarily committing to systematic closure, but rather to intervention to improve the quality of these institutions.
So I want to know, because of course one part that is essential as well is the divorce to the Pope and the Roman Catholic Church. Could this have happened, that this closure of the monasteries, without, let's say, if the Catholic Church has still been in power over England, if Henry had not divorced, as the saying is, from the Church of Rome?
Yes, it certainly could. Because the closure of monasteries had happened in previous centuries. The closure because they were considered not to be viable, or closure because they were considered to be of poor quality, had happened. And monastic authorities, so the governors of monasteries themselves, had sometimes argued for closure. So it didn't require Henry rejecting papal authority or the divorce in order to make it possible. And in some respects, I think it's important to keep the divorce and what we call the break with Rome standing apart from the process of dissolution. And certainly, if we look at what the monasteries themselves were thinking at the time that Henry divorced Catherine of Aragon, marries Anne Boleyn, rejects Rome and makes himself head of the church in 1534, monasteries did not think that simply because the king was now head of the church, that they would all be closed. On the contrary, they considered that this simply opened up a new era in which the church was governed by the king, but the monasteries would still have a place. Monasteries, after all, themselves had a conflicted relationship with Rome and the papacy. Monasteries were suspicious of the papacy. Monasteries even argued that the papacy tended to be corrupt. They preferred, in many respects, to be governed by the king than by the papacy. The only part of the monastic estate that saw the relationship with the papacy differently were the friaries. They owed their very existence to the papacy. Their orders, their networks had been created under papal authority, and they had an instinctive loyalty to the papacy. But for them, Henry making himself head of the church did not carry the same significance as for the monasteries, because the friaries did not own large properties. So Henry becoming head of the church did not compromise their authority, because they didn't have the economic power of the monasteries. So even the friaries don't assume, when Henry becomes head of the church, that their future is now uncertain. And they continue for the years following to assume that their life as institutions within this church now governed by the king would continue. So my argument really is, my way of seeing this period is that above all, Henry and Cromwell want to make the king, the crown of England, more powerful within the administration of the church. That's their primary aim. They would like to see reform, and they increasingly see closure of monasteries as a way of achieving that. But it's only late in the decade that they become convinced that closure of most of them, if not all of them, is necessary. And they begin to think of that only because they see the monasteries as perhaps no longer accepting Henry as head of the church. So as long as they think that the monasteries accept Henry as head of the church, I think it's very likely that Henry and Cromwell would have allowed monasteries to continue in some form. At the end of the 1530s, Henry becomes increasingly fearful that monasteries may not continue to accept his new position. And that's when he is more determined to see them closed. So the situation is changing all the time. It's a very volatile situation. What we above all, I think, have to discard is the idea that there was a coherent plan, a blueprint, if you like, and that at the beginning of the 1530s, Henry had a plan, a strategy, and he implemented it. It's clear that he didn't. His attitude changed, and that Cromwell himself didn't have a fully formed plan at the beginning of the decade, and that many decisions were made in the moment, in a very short-term way, and that what happened was often very unpredictable.
It's my understanding, I think most people think about this when it comes to the dissolution of the monasteries, is that the treasury was quite broke under Henry VIII's time before the dissolution. And of course, monasteries, at least the big ones, had quite a lot of gold in them. So the state of treasury, is that a part of why they chose to close it? At least in the beginning, the bigger monasteries that were out there and to just to get treasure into the royal treasury, or is that a misconception that people may have about the dissolution?
So there is an awareness that the monasteries hold both considerable property, portfolios of property, and yes, some cash resources. But it's only at the very end of this process that the wealthiest monasteries are closed. So if it was only about money, then logically, Henry would have targeted the wealthiest monasteries as a priority, and he doesn't. We have to understand that because monasteries are independent institutions and their property and wealth has come from benefactors, patrons, families in and across England and Wales, it's not straightforward that the Crown can simply seize that wealth because the nobility of England and Wales have a stake in that wealth. So yes, Henry's regime always needed money, but it was always understood that even if some resources could be taken from monasteries, that was always going to need to be negotiated with the nobility as well, because they would very quickly indicate that before that property came to the monasteries, it was theirs, and they had given it to monasteries as patrons. And so, in fact, although Henry does eventually take some cash resource from monasteries, in fact, the amount of money that he is able to raise from their property is not as much as is often assumed, largely because, in fact, he has to give it out to the nobility and the gentry in political society in order to maintain his position to secure their support. Also, the treasury is weakened in a sense by closing monasteries because the main source of income for the crown is taxation. And at the beginning of Henry's reign, whenever the church is taxed, he takes a very significant amount of money from the taxation raised from the monasteries. And of course, as soon as those monasteries are no longer there, they're not there to be taxed. And so even in the short term, it's very damaging financially for the crown to have all monasteries closed, because the tax income that earlier in his reign and in his father's reign, the king had relied on, has simply disappeared. Because as long as the monasteries were there, the king could tax the church, take income from them. Once they're gone and the property has been redistributed, there is no longer the same tax income. And by the time that Henry dies in 1547, the crown's income from taxation is a fraction of what it had been at the beginning of his reign. So there are the, it's something of a myth that the main motivation for closing monasteries was financial, because if your motivation was financial, you wouldn't have closed them because you needed the tax income.
So if it wasn't because, as I talked about, to sum it up a little bit, he wasn't quite committed to the monasteries, and it wasn't really the treasury that was the reason for the settlement, and Cromwell as well didn't seem... So what was the reason that they finally decided that this institution need to be shut down? What caused the final thought that, oh, this needs to be dealt with?
I think the key is Henry's headship of the church. So we have to think about the sequence of events. There's no doubt, as I've said, that Cromwell believed that monasteries needed reforming, as Wolsey had believed. And there's no doubt that they see advantage in closing smaller monasteries, rationalizing the monastic estate in England and Wales. But as long as Henry and Cromwell believe that the remaining monasteries are fully signed up to Henry's headship of the church, as they seem to be when it's first announced in 1534, it's unlikely that they are going to make a move against all of them. And so in 1534 into 1535, they want to continue to control them more. They want to bring them under the authority of the crown. In 1535, Henry and Cromwell introduce a set of reforms to ensure an improved quality of life inside the monasteries and to ensure more royal scrutiny of what they're doing. But still, they're giving every indication that they will continue. But two things happen to undermine Henry's confidence and Cromwell's confidence that the headship of the church is fully supported. The first in 1536, in the autumn of 1536, is a rebellion in the north of England. The rebellion is about many things. It's about the increasing control of life, economic life especially, from the government in Westminster. The rebellion is also about the incredible influence of Thomas Cromwell, and he becomes a hate figure. But the rebellion is also about having seen smaller monasteries being shut down in a region of the country where there are not very many towns or cities, and where the monasteries, as we discussed earlier, had played an important social and economic role. That rebellion strikes fear in Henry and Cromwell, and Henry is inclined to see it as an indication that maybe people have not bought into his headship of the church as much as he'd thought. Nonetheless, the rebellion is put down. And in fact, for many months after, there's no indication that the closure of monasteries is going to be pushed forward with any great speed. But by 1538 into 1539, there are enough rumours and suspicions that in different parts of the country, people are beginning to say maybe the king's headship of the church is not such a good move. Maybe things were better when the crown didn't have as much power as it has now. Maybe things were better when Cromwell didn't have as much power as he does now. That Henry becomes increasingly paranoid, I think we would say, paranoid that the headship of the church that he claimed in 1534 is beginning to be undermined out there in the kingdom, that people are beginning to say, we don't like this, maybe we shouldn't have supported it in the beginning. And rumours of conspiracies and plots are mounting, and it's that is encouraging them, Henry and Cromwell, to think that maybe as long as those monasteries remain, these whispers about the headship of the church will just get louder and louder and louder. And the opposition to the power that Henry's given himself will grow and become a serious threat. That is happening at the same time as the royal interference in the running of monasteries is getting to a level that the monasteries are really struggling to support themselves. The crown is making so many demands on their day-to-day running, demanding payments for this and that, and preventing them from running their properties as they've been used to do, that it's clear that some of them are beginning to feel that they can't go on, that much more of this, many more months of this sort of interference, and they won't be able to cope with it anymore. And so, if you like, there is pressure growing from Henry and Cromwell at the same time that a different sort of pressure, a sort of attrition within the monasteries, is making their resolve weaken. And the two combined to get together encourages a number of monasteries to say, we are happy to close.
Is there a worry with the rebellion that this will blow out an all full-scale civil war? Or is there just a worry that this is just another rebellion, we're going to put it down easily?
Yeah, it's more shocking than it is threatening, I think. I think the significance of the rebellion is that it, as I put it, it strikes fear into Henry. There is no danger that the Tudor regime could have been overthrown. There is no danger that Henry can't put down the rebellion. And it is put down very swiftly. But it sends shockwaves that are far greater than, if you like, the number of men who took up arms. So its impact is more, I suppose we might say, psychological than anything. That Henry had enjoyed a period for nearly 2 years of thinking his great scheme to make himself head of the church has succeeded. And so when there is a rebellion in 1536, suddenly he's panicked that maybe the support that he thinks he has out there in the country is not as deep as he assumed it was. And then 2.5 years later, by the time we're getting into 1539, that fear that maybe he's not been as supported as he thought he was, that fear is getting to a sort of fever pitch. At the very moment, as I say, that a number of monasteries are feeling that this new experience of being governed by the king is not really working. It's too costly for them. It's almost too exhausting for them.
And now I want to take a little time to compare the clergy of the monasteries in England versus that of the Habsburg land under Joseph II. And therefore, Jimmy, I don't remember if it was your book or in the Derek Bale's biography on Joseph II, which is brilliant as well. But I do believe that there is a comparison there, because unlike in England, it was more in the Habsburg and the Joseph II that it was shut down, because it wasn't really significant anymore. They were this, I don't know how the words are right now, but they weren't useful to them, and they were growing. They were this cruelty that we kind of associate the regime of Henry VIII, but it weren't necessary for a crown anymore. That's why Joseph shut them down. So I do believe there's quite a difference between Joseph II shutting down versus Henry VIII shutting down at the monasteries.
Yes, it's a very interesting comparison to make, in fact, because as we've talked about earlier, monasteries in England and Wales in the Middle Ages and into the 16th century are playing an important social, economic, cultural role. Joseph II targets monasteries for closure because he believes that they are not useful to society at all, that he considers that they are places where the monks and nuns are lazy, quite literally, that they indulge themselves, they are greedy, and they perform no service to the...
Well, there's some truth to that, or else it's just his thoughts on this?
I think there is some truth to that in the sense that the Habsburg monasteries are much, much larger, much more numerous in monks and nuns than in England. The English institutions had become quite lean institutions. They did a lot, and they did not have large numbers of monks and nuns. In the 16th century, in Henry VIII's reign, there are no more than about 12,000 monks and nuns.
Quite a large number still, though.
Well, in a population of what, 2.5 to 3 million, it's 12,000 people is not particularly
large. Okay, fair enough.
Large.
Yeah.
But in I think the typical estimate for the number of monks and nuns in Habsburg monasteries in Joseph's reign, it's something like 45,000. This is a very substantial. So you've got nearly four times as many monks and nuns. And so you can see at that point in the 18th century that people from the outside looking in at Habsburg monasteries would have felt these are crowded with people. They live a very good standard of living. And what do they do for those of us outside? That they were a sort of almost a refuge for the lazy. But it's very interesting that Joseph makes that argument that these institutions should be closed because they're not useful to society. What he does do with the property and the income from these monasteries is he really does invest that in schemes for society, in social schemes. And one of the criticisms that is made of Henry VIII's dissolution is that the property that is taken is given back to nobility and gentry. And actually, we see very few useful social institutions being established out of the wealth of monasteries. We don't see large numbers of schools or colleges or seminaries. We don't see money going to parishes and to priests. Whereas under Joseph, you really do see those schemes. That Joseph's vision, I think historians would argue now, is a sort of Enlightenment vision for creating a kind of a much more utilitarian scheme where useful institutions for society and education and welfare are created out of monastery wealth. And it's quite remarkable because by the time Joseph dies, much of this has been achieved out of what does he close? Maybe 700-800 monasteries. And we have colleges, schools, seminaries, new parishes, income stipends for priests created out of this monastic wealth. So it's one of the only instances in Europe's history where you get a transfer of property and wealth from monasteries into new social institutions.
I feel like Joseph II is such a misunderstood character, mostly because his brother did undo most of what he did again after his reign when he took over. And that is, of course, an episode in itself, but Joseph II is such a fascinating character, and especially as we've talked about with the monasteries. You see, unlike in England, this is And this is a whole other book, I'm sure, that maybe that's I hope coming out soon. But still, he is such a fascinating character, a misunderstood character in history, and history that need to be kind of need to be reformed in a way of its own.
Yes, I think you're right, and I think he deserves to be singled out for a quite remarkable revolution. It may not have lasted, but it is an extraordinary revolution of social organization to have such a substantial population and such a substantial body of property and wealth to be redistributed in this way. And given that this is occurring against at the same time as the Ancien Régime in France is coming to an end and so on, it's one of the only instances of the realization of a sort of enlightenment vision of society, that enlightenment notion of usefulness, of what we would call utilitarianism, that ideal that has been created in the Enlightenment, and is the product of all of those mid-18th century philosophers. Joseph's vision for the education of youth is almost the application of Jean-Jacques Rousseau's vision for education. And there, in Joseph's empire, it's being realized. It's being put into practice. I think it's a story that is one of those casualties of the sectarian divide in European history, that this is taking place in a Catholic country. Most historians who write on dissolution, reformation, are writing from a Protestant perspective. And so they overlook the significance of these episodes in Catholic regimes. Historians from a Protestant tradition tend to write about Protestant episodes, those from a Catholic tradition about Catholic
No, there's no
episodes.
in between.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it gets almost lost, I think, in the historiography, which is a pity. And one of the approaches that I try to make in my own work in this area is to break through those Protestant and Catholic perspectives, because I think they have had a limiting effect on the way that we approach the subject.
And before we move on, I want to say that Derek Baer's two-volume biography is marvelous in highlighting Joseph's career and his life. It's such a good biography. Though it might be a bit tedious to read at times, it's still worth reading through his work because it's such an excellent work, one of the best works for English readers out there who want to learn about Joseph II.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
But let's move on. We spoke a little bit about the process of closing, but let's talk about the actual closure. I'm sorry for derailing a little bit there, but I feel like this topic we should still bring up as well, the comparison. But let's talk a little bit about, the actual closure of the monasteries and the process that went through with the closure of monasteries, which has we have led up to this moment, is in order to understand how this process came about.
Sure. So I think when we look at a site of a monastery today in England or Wales, and we see often a shattered building, maybe a broken arch, and it conjures up the impression of a violent process. I suppose, in a sense, disappointingly, the historical reality is quite different to that. That those whose local monastery had been closed, in the course of the 1530s, might have been surprised by the fact that when they looked at it, they would have seen no difference, because the process is very slow. And even the removal of the inhabitants itself is a slow process. I think it's often said that some great events, great moments in history, turn out to be an awful lot of waiting around, of standing around. And I suspect the experience of a monastery being dissolved in Tudor England was a bit like that. A great deal of waiting around for something to happen. What we know is that the monks or nuns often, after the formalities of making a surrender to the crown authorities are completed, that they in fact return to the monastery buildings for some considerable time. The men would only be permitted to leave once they were licensed to change their status from monk to secular priest. And that was a process that could take weeks. So even if they weren't continuing to live inside the monastery, they were certainly living nearby. So it's a process that takes time to remove the people. It also is a process that does not see the demolition of the buildings very quickly at all. How those buildings look today is not an indication of any direct action against them at the time. Only a handful of buildings were demolished at the time of the dissolution. Many of them, in fact, the king orders to keep intact for months, even years afterwards, because there was no clear plan as to what to do with the buildings. Henry is interested in the idea that abbeys across the country might be turned into royal palaces. And so a number he orders to be kept without any materials being removed, while the possibility of turning them into palace buildings is explored. Other buildings are not demolished because the value of the building materials is such that it is ordered that they should all be kept in position rather than for there to be any damage to any part of the building. So it is a very slow process. Even after Henry's death, there are still sites which are standing empty, but more or less intact. I suppose today we would say that for a lot of sites, these would have looked as though they were mothballed. That is, they were locked up and standing empty, but they had not been taken down. The buildings were still complete. What does happen quickly is the removal of their treasures, the removal of the decorative art, the gold and silver plate, jewels, textiles, very rich textiles. And these items are taken and sold. And they're sometimes sold within a day or two of the closure of the community. And they are sold from the site of the monastery. And there is a very lively trade in these valuable furnishings. And they're bought by everybody, from quite ordinary people. Parishes come along and buy textiles so they can use them in their own parish churches. There is, I suppose you could say, a great garage sale of treasures.
So what happened to people who lived in the monasteries? Because you do write about that as well. So what happened to those when the monasteries were shut down?
So we have to make a distinction between what happens to the men and what happens to the women, because they follow different paths. The men, as I've said, they are required to be licensed to change their status from monk to what we call secular priest. So that is an ordinary priest, like a parish priest. When they get those licenses, they are able, if they wish, to work as priests if they can find a position. and some do, but all of those who have been in monasteries that are closed in the later phase after the closure of the smaller monasteries, they also receive a pension paid out of some of the income of the monastery, which is another reason why the crown doesn't take lots of money, because the income from the closed monastery is used to pay pensions to the monks and nuns. So the monks have a pension, which means that if they wish, they can live off the pension and not take a position in a church. And as far as we can tell, perhaps one third of those who are released live only off their pension, and perhaps two thirds take positions in the church. They are, of course, all of different ages, and the older men are less likely to take a position in the church. The younger men, of course, much more likely. For the women, they receive a pension, but of course, women have no opportunity to take a position in the church. So, what they do with their pension is some return to live with their families. Some come together with other nuns and actually set up house as a group. And increasingly, we're finding evidence that this is quite a common decision for former nuns to make, that they form a household together as a group of women, each of them receiving their nun's pension. And of course, that's a more economical way of living for them. And it's clear that these women do not always want to return to their family. As I said earlier, becoming a nun was a career choice. So they don't want to seek refuge in their family. They like their independence and they live independently, sometimes in groups. The other feature for the women is that as long as Henry remains king, they are not permitted to marry. This is another indication of Henry's traditional outlook. Henry is not a fully signed up supporter of Reformation religion. He takes their vows that they made when they became nuns. He takes them seriously, those vows of chastity. He does not want to see women who had made a vow of chastity
But
leaving.
sorry for interrupting you there, but let's say it was a man who wanted to, it was a monk who wanted to get married. Was that okay if a man who was a monk and he wanted to marry compared to the woman that Henry did not want to marry? Was that okay for a man to get married if he wasn't so wished to?
So they the majority of them don't, but they are released from their vows as long as so they are released. The men are released from their vows, but they become secular priests, and by the beginning of the 1540s those secular priests are marrying. So yes, former monks and friars begin to marry. It's still disapproved of, but they do begin to marry.
It's kind of hypocritical, though. Of course it is, because,
Yes,
women
of
aren't
course.
allowed.
And some women, we think, and it's difficult to find the evidence, some women do marry in secret. But when Henry dies and his son Edward takes the throne, the attitudes change, and Edward's regime is more reformist. And so the men and women can marry openly. But Edward's reign is very short. Edward dies in 1553. His sister becomes Queen Mary. She is a Catholic. And all of those former monks and nuns who've married now have to deny their marriages and return to living separately. So, for those that do marry, it is a very difficult journey over the next 20 years. What we know is that only a small proportion of these former monks and nuns do marry. But there are one or two instances of former monks and nuns marrying each other. We know that one of the former monks who becomes a bishop, so he has a career in the secular church. His name is William Barlow. He, in fact, marries a former nun, and they live as husband and wife. But those are quite unusual instances. I think, in summary, it's also important to say that the careers of those who leave closed monasteries, men and women, are very difficult for historians to follow. They do not leave very many records. We know them about them only where they leave wills, testaments, where they bequeath their property, and we can then know a little bit about how they are living. But those are rare documents to find. It's made more difficult in England because monks, especially when they are living in the monastery, they do not necessarily use their family names in records, but they take other names. When they leave the monastery, they then use their old family name again. And so it's difficult to match up the record of a man who was living as a monk with the records of men living outside the monastery. They may be the same person, but their names are different, and it's very difficult to prove that we have identified correctly a monk, because they may appear in the records after the dissolution with a different name.
So let's talk a little bit about the impact of society and how that, because as we spoke about in the earlier of this episode, if you remember that far back, they had cultures and religions, and they worked as a hospital for the sick, and they worked for you. They had a function in society, unlike as we talked about in the Habsburg monasteries. But what were the impact when the sick guy, for example, what about the so-called health care that we call it today? What happened with the community after these monasteries closed down?
Well, I think those social impacts are the most significant for the dissolution in England and Wales. There is no doubt that where there had been facilities for social welfare, for the giving of support to the poor, to the sick and the elderly, the arrangements that I was describing earlier for people in periods of plague, in outbreaks of plague, all of those facilities have gone. Monasteries did run a number of of hospitals, not all hospitals in medieval England. Some hospitals are independent of monasteries, but monasteries did run some, and those hospitals are closed. And so in cities and towns where there had been hospital institutions, they've gone, and they are not replaced. Again, the contrast with, say, the Habsburg dissolution, the resources taken from these old institutions are not used to create new ones. So towns, cities see social welfare facilities stripped away from their local environment. Schools, I think, are also a significant loss, and an immediate one. If we're looking for the immediate effects of the dissolution, we shouldn't think about demolishing churches because many of them are not demolished. We shouldn't think about even displaced people because, as I've said, monks and nuns don't necessarily move away very quickly. But we should think about the loss of these other social institutions. The loss of schools may be the most significant loss because most monasteries provided elementary education that's the teaching of literacy to children. Most monasteries across England and Wales offered some elementary schooling, and those are closed, of course, with the monasteries. And again, they are not replaced. And towns and cities spend much of the rest of the Tudor period trying to replace those school institutions that they've lost.
If I may interrupt you again, is the literacy going down after the closure of monasteries?
It's very difficult to measure because how do we measure
Oh.
literacy with the records that we have? I think what's diminishing are the opportunities, the routes into education. Those monastery schools had provided a first step in an education career for boys, young men, which might have led, for example, to university and then to a career in the clergy. So I think it's not levels of learning so much that are changed as routes into education. What today I think we would talk about as opportunity. There is, if you like, an opportunity cost as a result of this, that a wider cross section of society had been
So
able.
it was a sort of scholarship sent entering the
Yeah, yes,
monastery.
indeed. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. So, in Britain today, there is a debate about how when we had grammar schools in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, and children from poorer backgrounds were given the opportunity to go to a very good school and from there to go on to university. Then in the 1970s, they were closed. It's often said there is an opportunity cost there, that opportunity for poorer students to progress in education was lost. I think that's what we're seeing in 16th century England, that there is a loss of opportunity for education. The
So,
other.
I'm sorry for interrupting you again, but is it education and becoming more elitist after the 16th century
Yes,
of the main
undoubtedly.
elite?
Yes, undoubtedly. That we find a situation in which, in order to progress in education, you need money, you need perhaps a patron to support you. And until new schools are created to replace all of those that have gone, and they are not really created for generations, until they are established, new schools, then there are no opportunities if you are from a poorer background. The other immediate impact is the destruction of what we might call a kind of cultural heritage, cultural artifacts. Monasteries held very, very substantial libraries of books. You mentioned Bede earlier, of course. These institutions had been standing for centuries, and they had built up very large collections of books, learning of all kinds, ancient learning and new copies of the writings of classical Rome, but also much more recent scholarship, learning, science, literature, history, philosophy. And many, many, many of those books are destroyed because the libraries are simply broken up. Some books are sold, but more books are simply discarded. Of course, because some of the books contain learning which is falling out of fashion. And many of the books are manuscript books, they're not printed books, and they're not regarded as valuable to keep now that you can acquire printed books. We lose certainly tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of books. And this is an experience that is different from other regions of Europe. So the destruction of libraries and the loss of nearly a millennium of book history is perhaps the greatest immediate impact of the dissolution in England and Wales. And it's a distinctive impact because this is not the case in all regions of Europe. In the Nordic countries, undoubtedly also, there is a great loss of book collections when the monasteries are closed. And today, of course, we have very, very few examples of Norse literature, given what would have existed in those Nordic monasteries through the Middle Ages.
If I may, again, I was lucky actually to have the Snorri saga rediscovered in the 15th century
indeed,
because it was basically lost. And I'm not sure if it was stored in monastic, but it was still lost. And we are lucky that it was rediscovered and again found that Snorri saga as
absolutely.
Well as found.
In fact, the archives, the National Archives in Norway, have done some wonderful work recently to reconstruct fragments of monastic manuscript books that were preserved because they were in the bindings of later books. And they found, including, for example, the only instance that we have of the rule of Saint Benedict, the classic monastic rule, translated into Old Norse. And that is in a fragment in the Norway National Archives. It's a wonderful, wonderful survival to have. But in England, certainly tens of thousands, perhaps even more than that, are lost. And they're lost quickly because partly because they are mostly manuscript and they're regarded as outdated rather than printed books, but also because they're seen as containing material that is, of course, Catholic, superstitious. And so that is a very significant loss. What's interesting about the impact of the dissolution is that for many people who rented property that had been owned by monasteries, people who worked on land that had been owned by monasteries, for many of them, they would have not noticed significant changes. That there was a change in landlord, maybe the money they earned from their labor changed. In some cases, they did. But in other respects, when the monasteries close, their life continues as before. So I think we lose facilities and we lose artifacts, but the lives of people are sometimes not as affected as we might think.
If I may, because I don't know if this is the case in at least with coastal monasteries, in the Svar, for example, it wasn't just, but in North Trondheim, I don't know if you've been there, but there's a monastery there called Munkholmen, and it's on an island, and it has a really fascinating history of its own. It was a monastery, and when it was shut down, it was later fortified. It was used as a fortress as well. I do believe there is one in Kristiansand as well in Norway that was used the same way as a fortress after in the monastery. Was this the case? And this was the coastal monasteries in England. There were some fortified as well.
None of them are literally turned into fortifications. What they do with coastal sites in England is reuse the stonework. Cistercian monastery on the Isle of Wight, so on the south coast of England, is the stonework is taken down and used to build fortifications along the coast. We see most of the recycling of stonework in the early years after the dissolution is going into fortifications. But overall, monastery buildings are put to lots and lots of different uses. Quite a number of them are turned into industrial workshops. So in London, a printer takes over one of the friaries. In other places, they use these large spaces to make materials like rope, where you need a very large space. They are used for weaving workshops for looms to be erected for weaving cloth. So you find them being used in all kinds of ways. Again, in London, one of the sites is becomes a theatre because again, it's a large space. So by the end of the 16th century, so by 1600, you have monastery sites being used for an extraordinary variety of different activities. And of course, in England, I think it's fair to say perhaps more than in some parts of Europe, monastery sites are also turned over into private houses, into mansion houses. So we have a number of locations where even the church itself is built as or rebuilt as a mansion for a family. And so you find that the arches of the church have just become the great hall of the mansion house. And so there is a huge enthusiasm, I think, for using what were very grand buildings to be the grand buildings of the nobility and gentry.
I think you're gonna round it up there. Thank you so much for coming. It's been a pleasure to talk with you about this. Of course, before we go, do you have anything you want to promote on social media where people might find you if they have more questions about the dissolution of monasteries? Of course, we just did discuss the tip of the iceberg. This book is quite thick as it may seem, but it's highly recommended to read. If you find this topic interesting, so you should absolutely check out this book. So where can people find this book if they are interested in learning more about the topic we discussed today? And do you have anything else you want me to promote or links you want me to put in the description below?
Well, thank you very much indeed. It's been a pleasure talking to you this evening. Yes, you can find the book, I think, in pretty much any good bookstore, and of course in the usual places online, such as Amazon. It is now in paperback, I'm bound to say good value for money because it's a very long book. It is more than 200,000 words, there is plenty in there for anyone interested in Tudor England. You can find me on X at James G. Clark, and I do post on aspects of my research. I've recently come back from researching monasteries in Iceland. I have a project on monasteries and the dissolution in Iceland, so. Anyone interested in monasteries in other regions of Europe, please do follow me because I'm sharing that project as we discover more. I do have two new books forthcoming in 2025. One of those specifically on monasteries and the making of medieval Europe. So please do look out for that, and I will be
I
tweeting.
most definitely will.
Also upcoming, a final plug is for those of you who know the magazine Medieval Worlds and Cultures, the next issue that is about to come out, and you can buy it in the in hard copy, but you can also see it online, is actually on medieval monasteries. There is quite a bit in the magazine from me. But also from other historians who work on monasteries in different regions of Europe. In the issue, there are features on monasteries in Germany, again in Scandinavia and in Southern Europe, so as well as in Britain. If medieval monasteries, medieval books, the medieval practice of religion, architecture are your interest, check it out because you will certainly find something there.
Thank you so much again for coming on. It's been a pleasure. My name is Anne, and this has been About Age. Well, we are available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube. If you like this episode, please hit like, share, and subscribe. And of course, check out some other episodes. I'm sure you're gonna find something you may like. Just that we are available. If you are on Spotify, give us 5 stars. So that would be very nice. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, consider writing a review of our podcast if you want it. And I will try to read the review on this podcast if I see you. Thank you so much for coming on. This has been Without Edge World. Now, my name is Alan, and I'll see you next time.